Okay, I'm Dr. Klein. I'm one of the CL psychiatry attendings. And when I was talking with Dr. Storm, we were thinking about what would be a good topic today for a lecture that might be helpful for medical house staff. So I said, how about doing basics of psychopharmacology on the medical service? Okay, sounds like a great title, right? So I figured we'll try to fill in the blanks and go from there. I think the biggest issue that medical house staff have when you're dealing with patients with psychiatric comorbidity is, what do you do with the patients who have a known history, who come in on medication, and you don't know if they're on the right stuff or what they're on or whatever. Like if it sounds normal or if it sounds like this doesn't sound right. Okay? So I think the one thing I want to get across in this lecture is just really how to conceptualize dealing with patients who come into your medical setting, be it for medical problems or things, a change of mental status or whatever, and then kind of working it up so you know if you're doing the right things for them psychiatrically speaking, and so that they don't decompensate on your service or get sick. Okay. Number one thing you have to do is get a history, and you have to probe and really do some fact finding. And in being the receiver of like a lot of the consults that I do, I usually find that's the thing that's lacking on your guys' end in terms of doing that. Because like you might know that someone has a history of schizophrenia or they have a history of depression, but that always seems to be like about as far as it goes. No one's really being like curious about, you know, like more to the story, okay? So if I have to spell it out, really the what you should be doing is the following. You have to get what the current regimen is. And sometimes the patients themselves can't even tell you what their current regimen is. They just know they take three pills, and they take them twice a day, and they're a blue color one, and a pink one, and they take half of one. And you get these like really frustrating kinds of reports, you know. When that happens, you can do one of a number of things. Call their family members, call the people they live with, call their siblings, whatever, or children, and see if they can tell you anything about the medicine they get. If they have the bottles there, the prescription bottles are great because they have the doctor's prescribing information on it, and a lot of times they'll have it with contact information as well. So you can like just call the psychiatrist directly or call the pharmacy and just confirm what they're getting prescribed and when it was prescribed and all like that. Second thing is just to get the name of the provider and any contact information. I'd say about a good 20% of all the consults that are generated for psychiatry are basically things that you can do yourself. You don't need me to make the phone calls and do this stuff, because you really have to find from the psychiatrist directly what medications are the patient taking, how have they been doing, getting the background of what their baseline is or whatever, especially with patients who come into the hospital with like, you know, quote-unquote change in mental status. I mean, you might get people who you think are confused and, you know, whatever, delirious, demented, and this might really be them, and this is the way they've been for years. But, you know, the only way you're really going to get a good baseline is to get it from people who really know them. Even family sometimes is very unreliable. You have children of patients who really don't have even contact with their parents and even know what's going on with them and who they go see in the community, if they're even taking meds. As an aside of sorts, I'm going to be seeing a consult after this lecture. A gent who comes in with an interesting story. I really want to see what it is when I see it. I mean, this is the way it was presented by one of you folks, a guy who's, I guess, 50 years old, who supposedly like 30 years ago came home from school or work to his mother's house and just stopped talking and just didn't say anything. And that's like where life stopped. And so, like, he lived with his mother for 30 years. Now the mother died a year and a half, 2 years ago, reportedly. And he was followed at an outpatient psych clinic. And supposedly the clinic said they were going to terminate his medicines, but they want to follow him and see him once a month. And now he's like 50 pounds, probably underweight or whatever, looks cachectic, has an anemia, which I think might be a chronic disease, but you know, before you know, he might have some sort of like underlying malignancy. And he lives with his brother, and the brother and him supposedly have very separate lives, and they were never like even involved with the, you know, the patient, because the mother took care of everything and they just didn't have to deal. And now he's kind of like decompensated. Now the question is like, now what are we going to do with him and what is he like? So he's either really, really psychotic and whatever, or what? I don't know, I'll see. So, I mean, it just goes to show how, you know, you could like even be living with somebody like that and not even really be aware or be interested in what's going on with your family member and be able to provide any history. But, you know, sometimes you get lucky and you actually have people care and they can provide that info. So, just to recap, find out however you can what kind of meds the person is on, who the provider is, and the contact numbers, seeing if the person is compliant on the medications. Okay, so now let's say you know the person's on lithium, Depakote, and Zyprexa. Now what? Person comes into your hospital, and for whatever reason, what do you do with them? First thing you should be doing is getting a baseline blood level of these meds, because that's going to tell you whether the patients are even compliant or not, if they're even taking the medications. I mean, you have the history they're taking it, but if you have like a lithium level of like less than 0.12, which I think is our computer's baseline or whatever, it means they haven't taken it probably in days, you know? So at least you know where you stand. The other thing is patients who come in with a change in mental status, quote unquote, you know, maybe it's this is because of toxicity on their meds. So, I mean, you could tell pretty quickly if someone's toxic or not just by getting a lithium level, a Depakote level, a Lamictal level, I mean, whatever is their drugs of choice. And pretty much now you can get really a level of anything. SSRIs, generally, they don't take levels of, but the mood stabilizers, they certainly do, because most of them are used or, you know, for like seizure control as well. And tricyclics, you could also get levels of. People generally don't do it, and we're going to get to that later in my little talk, but I think it's really key on a medical service to take tricyclic levels, and we'll get into it. So when you get a patient who comes in on lithium, Depakote, Lamictal, you should be getting a baseline blood level. Make sure you specify that it has to be taken before the morning dose, if any, is given. Because if you do it after the morning dose is given, it's going to give you a false reading. So, like, I mean, you know, an hour after you get a lithium dose, you're going to get this high level. It's not reflective of what their you know, real blood level is. Lithium, it has a 5-day, quote-unquote, half-life. I say quote-unquote because there's really no metabolism of lithium. Lithium is a salt, so it goes in the way it comes out. It's not metabolized by or changed chemically in any way. It's just excreted through the kidneys. And when you start the medication or change the dose, you should generally get it after the 5th day. You should get a blood level, and that's going to reflect really what your steady state concentration is, and you're shooting generally for a level between 0.60 and 1. In our computer, that's about what it is. If you have someone who's manic or someone like that, you want to try to get them to as close as 1 as possible. If it's 1.1 or 1.2, I wouldn't get too bent out of shape. I think actually for our computers here, I think they might even go up to 1.5. But everyone sort of has their own internal, you know, like comfort zone, whatever. So I would say like 1 to 1.2 is where you should feel pretty good. The usual dosage range for lithium for adults is like 600 to 2100 milligrams a day. Usually you take in divided doses, and usually that's because people get a lot of GI upset if they take it all in one shot. Usually when I start it, I put them on 900 milligrams at bedtime, see if they tolerate it, see if they have any GI complaints or whatever, and it makes it easier just in terms of doing a blood level, because you're supposed to get it really between 10 and 12 hours after you had the last dose. So if you got it at 9 o'clock, I know when they do the blood draws 7 or 8 in the morning, you're going to get a pretty consistent blood level. You're going to know what it is. Okay, if you get someone who's on more than 2100 milligrams of lithium, I would question whether this is accurate, and maybe and call up their provider and see if this is really what they have them on, and if the person outside has been checking levels. Sometimes you get people who are cowboys, and they have them on high doses, and they tell you they haven't checked the level in 6 months to a year, and then you find they have a blood level of 2 or something, and they're having toxicity, and also they might be running the risk of having all kinds of kidney associated damage. You have lithium induced glomerulonephritis and all these like acute tubular necrosis, and it basically does cause kidney damage if you're not monitoring it correctly. Even long standing use is going to give you some kidney problems, maybe 20 or 30 years. The other thing is, if someone comes in on lithium, you should always check their thyroid functions, because lithium definitely affects your thyroid. And I guess it's rule of thumb, you try to get TFTs every 6 months to make sure thyroid function hasn't changed one way or the other. You can get either hypo or hyperthyroidism secondary to chronic lithium use. Okay. And if you're going to start anyone on lithium, you should be taking baseline TFTs, so if you have an irregularity in the thyroid functions, well, did you have that before you even started lithium, or was it lithium induced? At least you have an idea where you're at. For the elderly, a lot of the people that you are going to see on floors, lithium should probably be dosed somewhere in the range of like 150 to 600 milligrams. So it's probably a good third to a fourth of what adults, younger adults should get. Because when you're older, your kidney function, kind of falls short, and also the expanse in which all your medication goes, your body habitus and everything, because you're losing body fat, declines as well. So it's a much easier to get a high level on a small dose, and then for that same reason, it's much easier to become toxic if you're taking too much. Okay. Let me just say, if anyone has any questions about any of the medications or anything, feel free to ask, because it makes a lot more interesting for me, and maybe it'll be more interesting for you, especially if you have something practical or something you're wondering about some of these meds, because there are quite a few of them. Okay.
About fasciculates and SSRIs.
Yeah.
All these medicines are sometimes prolonged to 15.
Yeah.
So we have a patient that comes in for a different reason, something medical.
Right.
Happen to have a prolonged QT on the EKG, but nothing cardiac in terms of complaints.
Right.
All these medications and they're very stable on them.
Right.
So how do you handle that?
Okay. I'll tell you, it's a complicated question, and I'll tell you why. I never really thought it was such a hard question, but I know, like, Dr. Norden, when he was chairman, was very big on the QT prolongation thing. I always felt he went overboard with it. And it was always kind of like this political thing about how much I could say about it, okay? This is where I'm going to say. Like everything else, you have to watch what's going on, but you also have to keep a perspective on it. I mean, one of the most notorious medicines that give you QT, at least methadone. That's the big deal. The other ones, I'm not all that worried about. I mean, lithium will give you bradycardia, but I don't believe it really gives you QT prolongation. I mean, maybe if you're toxic, you can get it go into a block or something. But usually it's the bradycardia that's the more worrisome thing than anything else. That's what I recall. And neuroleptics, I have to confess, I'm a bit confused because I know his findings and what I've read are pretty different, okay? Like, Dr. Norden used to speak of Haldol being the worst medication in terms of QT prolongation. Yet, it's probably the most widely prescribed medication in the medical setting, especially for control of delirium, you know, agitation, all like that. And it's probably the most well-studied medication of all of them because it's so widely used, you know. So personally, I think it's a fairly safe drug, but it has to be used judiciously. And I'm going to get to that about antipsychotics when I get to it. I guess I start with mood stabilizers so I should finish it. But what? Yeah.
One more about lithium.
Yeah, sure.
Why does it cause leukocytosis in toxic doses?
Well, actually, it causes a leukocytosis anyway, and not even from toxicity. It's supposed to cause demargination at the walls of the blood vessels, that it gives you like a false high white. What?
Like a steroid stack?
Yeah, right, exactly. That's really what it is. So, I mean, if someone is having like a white count of 15,000, I mean, I'd want to know what this was temporally in relation to how long they've been on lithium and when they had blood work done before. I think usually you get the higher leukocytosis. I mean, you could check it. You get a higher white count more when you start the medication, and then afterwards it phases out. I mean, you don't keep with a white count.
We had a guy last week with 3.8 level.
Yeah.
A young woman who came in with toothpaste all over herself. Literally crazy.
Yeah.
Psych ward. And the white count was 20,000. And I was all looking for a source.
Yeah.
And then, you know, when I started reading about lithium, they say it wasn't in toxic doses.
How high was her lithium? Okay, so that's, yeah. But, I mean, hopefully most of the people you're going to see are not lithium toxic. That, I guess that's my point, that it is going to cause a bump in your white count going up, even on therapeutic doses. You know. I mean, the other thing you can see sometimes, if someone is agitated, their white count goes up in acute states of agitation. Just like their CPK goes up, their white count can go up. You can have a bump. But, so I think that's that. Any other questions? Okay, so I'm going to get back to the antipsychotic stuff in the QT. I'll try to. The Depakote, general dosing range is between like 750 and 3,000 milligrams a day. Again, generally you try to divide the dose. They have extended release forms that you could take of it. That's anywhere from 1,000 to 2,000 milligrams a day. I'm not sure how great the extended release preparations are, frankly, because, you know, I guess it was designed so that you can get like a steady state level, whatever. People still get toxic on it, even on those extended release things. And I think the pharmacokinetics of it are kind of eh. So I like to just go with the straight Depakote and try to break it up, you know, twice a day or three times a day and divide doses and see how it goes. Again, you got to do blood levels generally after like 5 days and see where you're at. Again, try not to take the don't take a blood level before you get the morning dose. Okay. One thing that's very common in people who are on Depakote is hyperammonemia. And so it's always good to get some baseline LFTs and get an ammonia level. And I know there's some controversy about that too, but I will say that I do know that with people who have high ammonia levels acutely, usually that is consistent with the delirium. People can be walking around with high ammonia levels all the time because their brain becomes acclimated to walking around like that. It's like being a renal patient who, you know, has a BUN of 50 and a creatinine of 3 or something, and that's them. But because that's what they're like chronically, your brain acclimates and you can be perfectly fine and lucid. It's when it goes up acutely is when you start to say, yeah.
Sorry, I just don't know. How is it going to change the management in any way from a high or low ammonia level? Doesn't correlate very well
anyway. Well, I don't think that's really true. That's what I'm just saying. Because I know that's what you guys are taught. That doesn't correlate. I don't think that's true clinically. I've seen a lot of people who were delirious and did have high ammonia levels. But it doesn't mean that that was the reason. Let me put it like this. If you, without any other cause or any other irregularity, a high ammonia level can cause a delirium. They will cause a change in mental status. It happens acutely, like over a few weeks, that all of a sudden it crept up. But what I was trying to say before, if you're always walking around with that, after a while your brain might get used to it, especially if you're younger. If you're older, it's easier to tip you over that you're going to lose it. Has it changed the management? I mean, basically, you just could put them on lactulose and try to get their ammonia level down and see if that improves their... you shake your head, no?
They don't follow the ammonia. They don't even check it. They just take lactulose and go by the metal, like by the encephalopathy, the encephalopathy.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I mean, I guess the next time someone has a change of mental status, I'll tell you to call a GI specialist and tell them to manage it. Sounds like a solution. What else was there with Depakote? Basically, Depakote and lithium are really the two main mood stabilizers that you're going to see outside. One that's more up and coming is Lamictal. And you have some people on that. The biggest worry with Lamictal is it can cause a Steven Johnson syndrome if you crank up the dose too quickly. So you have to really start it very low. Generally, it's like, you know, 25 milligrams a day or BID to start. And then, like, every week you'll put it up another 50 milligrams. You have to, you know, titrate up slowly. If someone has been off Lamictal for several weeks, you can't just put them back on the same dose they were at. So if they were on 300 or 400 milligrams a day, you can't restart them when they come into the hospital on 400 because you run the risk of Steven Johnson again. That's probably going to schlag them out too. They're going to be really very sedated. So it's good to do a slower titration if they come in. If they come in off the street, you know they've been compliant and they've been taking it, by all means, continue them just on the same dose. Okay? That's pretty much all I have to say about mood stabilizers unless there are any other questions. Again, you know, the point of this talk is just to be practical in terms of your management, because you get people in all different states of psychiatric management, and you don't want to like under-medicate them or over-medicate them. You just want to keep them stable so they don't decompensate, and you don't want them to get medically ill and complicate their the presentation in the hospital when they come in, you know. Antipsychotics. A lot of times, less is more. Okay, so usually people, even psychiatric patients, generally shouldn't be on more than, let's say, 20 or 30 milligrams of Haldol at any given time. It's very unusual in this day and age that people have to be on more than that, especially if they're going to do it in combination with other neuroleptics. People you get from BPC usually are on huge amounts of medication, and that creates problems for you because you get them when they're having a change of mental status or thought to be confused, as like, now what do you do with them? Because, you know, they have them on two or three different antipsychotics, you have them on mood stabilizers, you have them on benzos. They use pharmacy with a very, very heavy hand, pretty much because these are the really chronic patients that they don't really have any other choice. They're kind of like, what else are we going to do with them? They're really, really sick, and they really bump up the meds. But it makes it difficult for the medical clinician to have to deal with this kind of stuff, because then, you know, the patient kind of craps out, and then it's like, well, what do you do now? Now you're stuck with this person who's on huge amounts of meds. So you have to take it on a case-by-case basis. So, if you're going to see someone who's on more than 30 or even 40 milligrams of Haldol a day, question whether this is right and why. Okay. There had been a study by Arthur Rifkin that was done about 20 years ago. It was a pretty good study. It was called the 10-30-80 study, and they basically showed that like 10 milligrams of Haldol was as efficacious as 80 milligrams of Haldol for, you know, most people, because it does pretty much the same amount of dopamine blockade, you know, that you get when you get to a certain amount. It's like a joke, you know. You don't need to add more Haldol, it's not really going to accomplish anything clinically. Usually what I try to do if I prescribe antipsychotics is max out as much I can on one before I even consider adding on another agent. I usually think it's very bad psychopharmacology to like have someone on multiple meds, but you have them on a little bit of this and a little bit of that. Because if you didn't really max out on one, you never really know, like, why did you even need a second or third agent? Maybe one medication is enough, and you see how they tolerate that before you start adding. So, you know, if I get patients who come in from the outside and they're on like five different meds, but they're all on like baby doses of each of them, I usually want to wash them all off, wash them out, and then start them with just one medication. And you might see that in the patients you're getting also from outside. There are a lot of stuff, but they're on small amounts, or they're on huge amounts of all of them. And then you have to question that too. So, again, I mean, the usual dosing regimen for Haldol, excuse me, is probably about, let's say, half a milligram at bedtime to maybe, you know, 20 or 30 milligrams a day. The people who take half a milligram are probably demented people who just need something for sundowning and for agitation. And when I was saying that less often is, you know, is better than having more, well, I should say that less is more, that should be for the elderly population. You don't have to give an 80-year-old person 5 milligrams of Haldol a day for agitation. It's usually overkill because it already has anticholinergic side effects, the Haldol itself, and then when you add this medicine to them, they can have an anticholinergic delirium and be cognitively more impaired just because of that. Usually a half a milligram of Haldol at bedtime can do a world of good, especially in an elderly person who's like visibly more confused in an ICU setting or something like that. The PLNs also, I wouldn't give more than, let's say, a milligram PO or IM every 6 to 8 hours for an elderly person. So someone's in their 70s or 80s, I go with small amounts. I don't like wallop them. Usually the surgeons, they do like this 5 and 10 milligram Q4 stuff, and then they're like, the paper, people are either schlocked or agitated, and they wonder why, and then they call me. And it's like, I usually know that's why, okay? When you talk about QT prolongation, one of the things you really should be concerned is, like, I would try not to use IV Haldol in someone unless they're in an ICU setting. And the reason being, just for that, reason of monitoring, just to make sure they don't have QT prolongation, that's much more prevalent when you give it an IV because you have less breakdown of the medication. And since you are monitoring them closely, at least if you have to do it, you can give it there. I wouldn't advise doing it on a regular medical setting, maybe on telemetry if they're really being followed, but I would not do it. I guess I would think of it more like the propofol with Dr. Conrad that they talk about. You don't do it on the outside. That's something you do in an ICU, and that's it. If you mean bioavailability as in terms of like rate of action,
in terms of is 1 milligram IM equivalent to PO equivalent to IV as far as that is?
It's equivalent for the antipsychotic properties, but if you're talking about getting a response in terms of timing, I mean, IV is probably the quickest if you want to deal with agitation. And then IM would come second, and then PO would come third. Pretty much the same way would be with, like, benzos. So if you're giving, like, Ativan or Haldol, PO, it probably takes about 45 minutes to an hour for it to start to kick in for agitation. IV, it's probably, 10 minutes. IM, probably about half an hour. So you shave off a little time. Just as a side note, I generally try not to give antipsychotics IM routinely unless there's some reason for it, because you have some people who have like low platelets, and then you have to subject them to repeated IMs. You run the risk of them having problems with bleeding. So it's really needless and kind of even dangerous to kind of expose someone unless you absolutely need to give them that route, luckily on medical services, you have a little bit more flexibility in terms of medication with neuroleptics than we even have on psychiatry. If you have someone on medicine who needs to be on an antipsychotic, you can write and it should be given. The medication could be given PO, and if the patient refuses, it can be given IM. On psychiatry would be, if they refuse, they have the right to refuse, and then they can be given IM if they're agitated. The reason why there's a little bit more flexibility on our medical services is because, you have to treat the medical problems. If it causes a problem in terms of management for the floor, then you couldn't take care of any patients. And they're not there primarily for psychiatric stuff. They're there for their medical reasons. So, if someone really needs to be on antipsychotics, there's no reason why they shouldn't be. I know it's a pain for staffing and stuff, but once someone gets their antipsychotic meds, generally things even out, and then they can maybe be more compliant and take a PO, so you get over that rough spot. Other antipsychotics that you see generally now are Seroquel. I think those are probably the two big ones. Risperdal also. Risperdal is somewhat in between the old and the new guard. I mean, Haldol is like the first generation, you know, typical antipsychotic. The Risperdal is somewhere in between, because when you get to higher doses, like, 6 milligrams and higher, max is really 10 a day of Risperdal, it starts behaving more like Haldol. And so you have to worry about the QT prolongation and people becoming Parkinsonized and getting stiff, just like you do with the, Haldol or Prolixin. The other stuff, the Seroquel, the Zyprexas, all the newer things, the big rant is about the endocrine and weight and diabetes stuff, and those are real problems. So you really, if you're going to be starting someone on these meds, you have to monitor their blood sugars and kind of like follow their weight, see if they're not gaining weight, excessively. I used to see people when Zyprexa first came out, they'd be on Zyprexa, and you get these women who, like, after a month, they'd be on like 20 milligrams of Zyprexa, they'd gain like 20 pounds. It was all within the belly. They looked like they were pregnant. And, and it happened, I won't say very frequently, but enough that, you took notice. And these women weren't pregnant. It was just, it deposits fat right on the abdomen. And when you see that, you know that they're set up for getting diabetes. It's not like the classic fat distribution that you get with other meds or with people who only have it on their thighs and the butt. And those are the ones who are at low risk for getting diabetes. It's the ones that get it all in the abdominal region. And those people, you should generally try to get them off those kinds of agents and maybe just see if you can put them on the older stuff, because it's a lot safer in that regard. We had about 20 minutes, so I'm going to try to talk about antidepressants and get to any other questions or things you're talking about. Tricyclics, in this day and age, are used very sparingly. The only reason I probably see anyone on a tricyclic is either for neuropathic pain management, or maybe for migraines. And if like the psychiatrist is like 70 or 80 years old, and this is what he used to give 50 years ago, and they're just comfortable with it and it works, okay. That's pretty much the reason why I see tricyclics used now. In the elderly, tricyclics can become very problematic, if not dangerous, because they usually metabolize them about a third of the rate as younger adults. And if you have a higher level of tricyclics in your bloodstream and you're elderly, you run the risk of getting, heart block. And one thing you might also notice is that elderly people might be on, polypharmacy, and it's easy to cause drug-drug interactions with tricyclics. A famous one is if you're on, let's say, an SSRI and a tricyclic. So let's say you're on 20 Prozac a day, and you're taking 50 milligrams a day of, amitriptyline or something for neuropathic pain from diabetes, okay? You might find that your blood level is tripled because of the Prozac, and just at baseline. And then if you get an elderly person who's on that could be really dangerous. So I would always, try to get a tricyclic level in elderly people who are on tricyclics, even if they're on baby doses, because you don't really know how they're metabolizing them. And also follow them cardiac-wise to see if there's any evidence of block or cardiotoxicity. The main medications, I think, that are used now for depression are SSRIs and the other, let's say, more atypical antidepressants work with like two different neurotransmitters, like the norepinephrine and SSRIs, the serotonergic ones. So you get like Effexor, you get Wellbutrin, you get Remeron. Those are the other ones. I'm still very comfortable with the old guard SSRIs, and I probably use them more than anything. Effexor, I'm not really a big fan of. It's more activating, which is good, but I see that there's a very high incidence of high blood pressure in people who are on Effexor, and a lot of them have these bump ups in blood pressure that you wonder why all of a sudden their blood pressure went up. Or the worst case scenario is they're being treated for hypertension and someone on the outside put them on Effexor. I would try to like get them off Effexor and see if it can be avoided if they already have a history of hypertension, because it's only going to make things worse in terms of your management of the hypertension. Remeron is kind of interesting because it's very sedating at low doses and works better as an antidepressant at higher doses. So if you put someone on like 7.5 to 15 milligrams of Remeron a day, it'll help them sleep great. If you bump it up to 30 milligrams a day or 45, it probably won't do all that much for their sleep, but it'll help their mood get better. You know, so just be aware that, you know, you could use it to your advantage in a way if you want someone to sleep. And that's what some internists do also. I wouldn't advise it, but people do it. Okay. Prozac, Zoloft, Celexa. Celexa is known to or touted to be the safest of the SSRIs if you have a polypharmacy, if you're on 10 different medications for whatever things, it has the least incidence of drug-drug interaction. But I always found that interesting that you also need a two-week supply of Celexa to suicide successfully. So if, I always kind of wonder if it's so safe, how come you can suicide on that? And like Prozac, you could take like 2,000 milligrams a day and people survive fairly readily in an overdose. So it just seems a bit incongruous. But if I'm going to go with what they say, I mean, Celexa is probably the easiest medication to prescribe for someone who's elderly or on polypharmacy for all kinds of things. Now you have the other one, Lexapro, which is used a lot, and that's like the, I guess, the mirror analog of the molecule for Celexa, for citalopram. But but you actually need like half the amount. So like 40 milligrams of Celexa is supposed to be as efficient as 20 milligrams of Lexapro. Even though it's the same molecule, it's like the mirror image of it. It's supposed to have a different efficacy, whatever. But here I think on formulary they don't have Lexapro. So if someone comes in on Lexapro, I would try to keep their dose the same just by that formula. So someone's on 20 of Lexapro, you could put them on 40 of Celexa to start, and that should be equivalent to what they're getting clinically, you know. It's also probably about as high as you should be really going. Like Celexa, I think the maximum is about 60 milligrams a day. That's probably about as high as it should go. And Lexapro is probably about 20 milligrams. That's usually where I feel comfortable. Sometimes maybe for people who have obsessive compulsive disorders, they push that higher. And you might ask them, if someone comes in on, let's say, 100 or 120 milligrams of Prozac a day, which is like a whopping dose, it might be for OCD. And it might be okay, as long as you're not having any side effects and you tolerate it okay. That's acceptable. For depression, any more than 40 milligrams of Prozac, you're probably wasting your money. It's not really going to have more of an antidepressant effect. You know? One of the reasons I like it also is because it's great in a lot of the drug abusing patients that we see, which I guess we see a lot of them at Jacoby, people who are using cocaine and or alcohol. It has a little bit more of an activating effect, and people who use cocaine usually find the Prozac to be great. It gives them a little bit of a buzz. It's a little bit more activating, and so it's easier for them to maintain compliance with it because they like the way it makes them feel. Zoloft, I generally find, is a more sedating kind of antidepressant. So if you don't have someone who has a lot of who's complaining of how should I say, like being really hyper or something like that, if you want them to be a little bit toned down, a little sedated, I would go with like Zoloft. That's usually my preference. Paxil is known to have crying jags as a side effect with abrupt discontinuation. It could probably happen with other SSRIs too, but I think Paxil is the one that they really talk about the most in the papers. So if you're on 40 of Prozac and you stop abruptly, people have these really bad crying jags that they find very disconcerting because they're like, they cry at the drop of a hat, nothing's going on, they just start blubbering. That's a side effect of the discontinuation of the Paxil. And it's remitting, it stops in time, but you shouldn't be abruptly stopping it, you should be tapering it down. So if you're in an outpatient clinic and you want to get some more of Paxil, try to, you know, cut it down 10 milligrams every week, don't just cut it short. Okay. I don't know if there's any other questions.
How about the seizure threshold? I know there's an issue with, I think, Celexa will issue the seizure threshold.
For which one?
Celexa.
See that's another, I guess, example where, you know, when they play up medicine to be very safe, but yet it has these kind of side effects. Okay, a few basics about antidepressants with seizure threshold. You generally should try to avoid using Wellbutrin in someone who has a known seizure history, because that's the notorious one for lowering your seizure threshold. However, if you're on Wellbutrin SR, they actually found that was like pretty much equivalent in terms of lowering seizure threshold as any of the other SSRIs. So if there was no other reason that you had to use Wellbutrin, you could do it fairly safely with Wellbutrin SR, as long as you're monitoring it, and maybe the person is working with a neurologist and gives you their okay. And, you know, the neurologist should always be involved, especially when you're given Wellbutrin. Prozac and Paxil, I usually don't have any qualms about giving someone that. Even Celexa, I frankly don't even prescribe it all that much because I'm not all that impressed with it. I kind of think it gives you a half-baked response when you use it for antidepressant, you know, as an antidepressant. It kind of gives you a little bit of a benefit, but it's never quite as good as the other ones, you know. Tricyclic certainly can lower your seizure threshold. So again, it doesn't usually come up clinically that much that you even would give it, but you should be aware that it can happen. And it's nice to see if someone has some sort of form of coverage from other ways to maybe give you some protection. Like if someone has neuropathic pain, gabapentin is used very often as a agent for neuropathic pain and also as a mood stabilizer. It's probably a second level mood stabilizer. It's not as good as lithium or Depakote or Lamictal, but some people use it, and you can actually go up to about 4,000 milligrams a day because it all passed through the kidneys. It's not metabolized in the liver. It's a pretty safe drug as long as your kidney function is good. And that might give you some benefit for preventing you to bottom out and have a seizure if you have that on board. The same as it would be if someone's on a little bit of a standing benzo, like a little bit of Klonopin daily, or Ativan as a standing. It might give you some coverage that you're not going to have a seizure. So it's good to see what they're on for other things that you might get an extra benefit just because they're on something else for another reason.
So we shouldn't avoid SSRIs in seizure patients?
I wouldn't.
Or would you not adjust their other medications? And would you feel comfortable just giving an SSRI without adjusting anything else?
Well, when you say without adjusting anything else, they're on...
They're on anti-seizure medication.
Yeah, I think I would feel comfortable keeping it the same. I mean, again, let the neurologist know who's prescribing, you know, that you're doing it, and just make them aware of it. So then I guess if they see they're going to have an increased incidence of seizures, they can make the adjustment. Now, I know in your particular situation, when you're in medical clinic, how many people are you starting on anti-seizure meds yourself, or do you?
The issue came up was on, like, the regular medical floor with the patients who have seizures.
Yeah.
And even in the psych consult mode, it said, you know, selects a parentheses lower seizure threshold, use with caution.
Yeah, I'm a bit more relaxed about it maybe than others. I've never really seen it cause all that many problems. The Wellbutrin, I think, is really the one that's the one that I would use with caution. But again, if you could use it as a sustained release, it's supposed to be a lot safer. Any more questions? We got like 5 minutes left. Okay, so I guess just to close, the most important thing you can really do in a medical setting is to take really a good history of what the people are currently on and who's giving it, and try to ascertain what the compliance of the medications are. And you could certainly do that by doing blood levels when they come in, just to get a baseline to see where people are at. And then, you know, like everything else, you try to take it by a case-by-case basis and see if the medication regimens sound normal, at least from the dosing that they're taking, this in relation to the age of the patients. You know, so if you get an 89-year-old woman on 2,000 milligrams of lithium, question that very quickly, that there's something off, and make sure that they're not toxic. Okay, that's it. Thanks.
Thank you.